So I thought today we would discuss more examples of geometric quantization. So the first example I want to discuss is something I mentioned last time. Suppose my symplectic manifold is S1 cross S1, the coordinates EQ and I'm going to let capital P e to the 2 pi I little p capital Q little q, and we're going to take the symplectic form B I'm going to make an effort to get the various factors of I and factors of 2 pi correct. And there's some convention, which is I've corrected by a factor of I. EQ is minus I H bar, and that's equal to the Poisson bracket times 1 over II. So
the conventions are amazing.
Included a function of H bar in the form. Again, this is really just conventions. And there's a factor of I here, and this is to get some kind of some signs by it when we look at the spectrum of graders in quantum mechanics. I'm just trying to get this right, but don't worry about it too much.
Shouldn't we have a star product between P and Q instead of Poisson bracket?
It so happens because P and Q are linear,
the Poisson bracket is constant. So this series expansion, the star product terminates. So these conventions, E, 2 pi I P e to the 2 pi I Q e minus 2 pi I P The way the algebra works when I look at this kind of exponentiated group version of the commutator. I just pick up an exponential of what I found there. Am I getting this right? Yeah, so that's I find e to the 2 pi I q, and q is shifted. So that's E minus 2 pi I squared times I H bar. And then I want to take the quantize. You want the area be n. So that means what the area is written is just the integral of this expression. So it's 1 over 2 pi I h bar. So that's going to be n. So h bar is 1 over 2 pi n. So that this expression here is equal to e to the 2 pi pi q e to the 2 pi I over n. Alright, so I hope the conventions and normalizations aren't too confusing. I find them a little confusing myself. But what we've ended up with is if we take the area to be n, then my commutation relations are expressed in terms of the nth root of unity. Our equation pq equal to q times p times e to the 2 pi I over n.
Question for the convention with the commutator, is this an exact result or are there higher order h bar terms that we're not writing?
Yeah, good question. So this is in this particular case, if I stuck some complicated function of p and q, there would be higher order terms. But because it happens that the Poisson bracket of p and q is just a constant, there's no further terms. So this only happens because I'm working in coordinates where the symplectic form is dp dq. OK, so last time, we saw that Bohr-Sommerfeld orbits are the circles where u is a root of unity, an nth root of unity. So that means, i.e., little q is k over n for k equals. I draw a picture. Here's my torus. And the Bohr-Sommerfeld orbits, there's n of them. They're equally spaced. This maps to the circle, which has coordinate q. And there's n equally spaced points on the circle. And the area between two circles is 1. That's it. This is how it always works. When I go, these were two-dimensional systems. It's more complicated for high-dimensional systems. When I go from one orbit to the next, I'm adding on one unit of area. OK. So I want to show that the Hilbert space spanned by these states is a representation of this algebra. How do we do that? So, well, let's first write down a basis for the Hilbert space. Well, let psi k be the state corresponding to q equals k over n. This is the kth Bohr-Sommerfeld orbit. Now, we can kind of just see how some of the operators act on this. Capital Q acting on this guy, well, classically, capital Q, just on this circle, it takes value a root of unity. So that's going to hold the quantum level too. We'll just declare. So we define that capital Q acting on psi k is equal to this is reasonable as on the orbit. Q takes value e to the 2 pi k over n. So this is going to be a good ansatz for quantizing these systems. If I have some operator which takes some constant value on the orbit, then the state corresponding to that orbit should be an eigenstate with that eigenvalue. Okay. So how do we find this commutation relation? So what does P do? So is anybody, if I erase the board as a guess for what P should do?
Could it be multiplying by k to k plus 1?
Yeah, it sends psi k to psi k plus 1. Actually, psi k minus 1. Better, but yes. So to see this, little p is related to e by dq, to some factor. So capital P is going to be related to e to the 2 pi, if you get the factors right, over n. Well, e to the 1 over n. E by dq. Because capital P is an exponential of little p. So what does this mean? Capital P shifts little q by 1 over n. We get the factors right. So now we do what you just said. So we declare that P of psi k is psi k minus 1, and then p q psi k is e to the 2 pi I k over n, p psi k is e to the 2 pi I k over n times psi k minus 1. And if we do it in the other order, qp psi k is q psi k minus 1 e to the 2 pi I k minus 1 over n k minus 1. So that pq is equal to qp times e to the 2 pi I over n. So the picture is you have n states arranged in a circle. Q each state is an eigenvalue for Q, and P moves you between them. So I'd like to do a couple more examples. The next example would be the harmonic oscillator. Are there any questions about this? Yeah.
Would the P projection give the same Hilbert space?
Yes, except you're taking a different basis in which P is diagonalized. And the relationship between the two bases in the same Hilbert space is kind of a discrete Fourier transform. So what's the basis for Q here will become a sum of the other ones weighted by some roots of unity. And that will diagonalize P.
A good way of thinking about this multiplicative commutation relation, like should we think of it as a Taylor series where it's just like a bunch of terms in the commutator, or it's just like a completely different kind of relation?
No, you should think of it as a Taylor series where I have you think about this expression, it's a big series in powers of P and powers of Q. And then if you play around with, like, what happens if every time I move a P past a Q, I pick up some factor of H bar, and there's some combinatorics with, like, taking care of all the factorials and the exponentials. But if you do it right, you'll find I move all the P's to the right, and the only thing that appears is some exponential of h bar. All the powers of h bar you get from moving a p past a q sum up to give you that. Yeah.
So when we define the action of the operators on the Hilbert space, we just define it on the set of state psi k.
Yes.
You know that's a spanning set.
Oh well. The ansatz we're using is that that the basis for the Hilbert space is given by the set of Bohr-Sommerfeld orbits. That's the picture we're using. We're just declaring that that's the Hilbert space, and it seems to work in examples. So in this example, I want to try and figure out, so let me try and get the factors right. So here, phase space is OR2. Symplectic form is dp dq over 2 pi h bar. And the Hamiltonian is p squared plus q squared. So we want to find, to use the Bohr-Sommerfeld method, to determine the spectrum. So we'd also like to compare what we get from, or to what you've learned from other ways of computing the harmonic oscillator spectrum. So recall that E is going to get sent to, say, minus I d by dq h bar. So the Hamiltonian gets sent to minus h bar squared by dq squared plus q squared. And the Hamiltonian is equal to, up to a shift, and there's some kind of plus h bar, which is irrelevant. And I'm going to ignore that. And if you say this operator B, I'm just going to remind you of the ladder method for computing the spectrum.
What is that plus h bar?
Oh, there's just, if you multiply this out and compare it with that, there's an extra term, it's a constant. But it's not important in, it's not important for our analysis because that's just an overall shift in the energy levels. Let's call it the zero point energy. So how does this work? So B is going to be a raising operator. A is a lowering operator. And so A times E minus half U squared over H bar is equal to zero. So by the usual argument, the eigenstates are E to the N and the eigenvalues are 2h bar n, for n equals 0, 1. Okay, this is that. This should be the very familiar determination of the spectrum of the harmonic oscillator, which you've seen several times. So what we'd like to do is reproduce this spectrum by thinking about the Bohr Sommerfeld orbits. And what I like about this is that you can actually see the states as geometrical objects in the phase space. So omega is, say dq dp over 2 pi h bar. Let's choose polar coordinates or theta. So P is or cos theta, Q is or sine theta, and then omega is minus or over 2 pi h bar, E or E theta. So we want to say omega is dA over 2 pi I, for a unitary connection, So to do this, we take A, B, I minus I or squared over 2h bar d theta. So this is, you know, we write our symplectic form as a field strength, a U1 gauge field. So up to this normalizing factor of 2 pi I, and here we've done this. Now, and the Bohr Sommerfeld orbits are going to be those values of OR, or the exponential of the integral of this is 0. Oh, sorry, 1. So how will we achieve this? This will happen if the integral of A is an integer, or 2 pi I times an integer. Can people see over here? Okay. What's that, sir?
Why is the U1 gauge field and not the gauge field?
Well, I don't have a good kind of, I don't have a very good philosophical answer to this. It has to be a gauge field for either the group U1 or the group OR, because the symplectic form has a single component. I took some other gauge group, the field strength would have many components, because it would have a Lie algebra index 2. We don't want that.
But theta and r are spaced in coordinates, and it can be Lie algebra valued where it's a summation of all generators, but there is only 1 d theta.
I'm not sure I follow.
We can write A as AI DI, where DI are the generators of Lie algebra, and then.
Yes.
Which
that's right, but then when you take the field strength, you will find the field strength also has a Lie algebra index. And you have to strip that off somehow.
Okay.
So, I mean, if it was UN, the only way to strip that off is to take the trace. And that's just throwing away the SUN part. And you're left with a U1 gauge field anyway.
So it can be SUN, but then you'll have to take the trace and the field strength.
And then, and you're getting rid of the SUN part and just left with the U1 part. So maybe more abstractly, if you took some gauge group, the field strength lives in the adjoint representation, and but the symplectic form lives in the trivial representation. So you need to have some copies of the trivial representation inside the adjoint representation, which means you have a copy of U1 in your group. That kind of factors off. Let me rewrite this equation. A is minus I or squared over 2 pi, 2 h bar. And we want integral from theta equals 0 to 2 pi of A is 2 pi I n for an integer n. So to achieve this, of course, this integral from 0 to 2 pi of A, well, the d theta just contributes 2 pi minus I or squared over 2 h bar 2 pi. So this will happen the Bohr Sommerfeld orbits are when the 2 pi I cancels out, the minus sign is irrelevant because we can take it to be a negative integer. 4 squared is equal to 2h bar n. So, hold on a little picture. This is P, this is Q. There's one orbit there, that's 0. One orbit when it's 1. One orbit when it's root 2, and so on. Just as a sanity check, the area of a disk goes like R squared. So if I want them, if I want each little annulus between these two circles to be an integer, then the radii have to go like roots of the integers, because there's this an R squared in the area. Okay, so now we've kind of solved the problem. The Hamiltonian is R squared. So we conclude if we set psi n, be the Bohr Sommerfeld orbit for R squared equals 2h bar n, then the Hamiltonian on psi n is equal to 2h bar n psi n. Then we find the same spectrum. That we did before. So the familiar states of the harmonic oscillator, which we computed algebraically using the ladder method, using this method, we just see them very geometrically as these circles. The spectrum is just the value of the Hamiltonian on that circle.
It seems, it seems the gauge field A, it's somehow a pure, it's a piece of data that's only, let's say, it's not part of the dynamics. It doesn't know, it was constructed out of omega, which seems to be part of the symplectic structure that's independent of dynamics at all. And yet, somehow we used it to extract information about the spectrum for a specific h. So at what point did we implicitly assume an h to be related, such that it's related to A?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So, and you're absolutely right, the gauge field is about the kinematics. And the Bohr-Sommerfeld orbits themselves are also about the kinematics, because they just tell me, what are my states in the Hilbert space? You have to do something else to figure out what's the value of the Hamiltonian in those states. So the thing we used in order to have a nice relationship between the Hamiltonian and the Bohr-Sommerfeld orbits is the fact that the polarization, like remember when we quantize, we have to say everything is, we have to choose a mapping to some base space, say everything is independent of the fiber variables. Here, we're doing a radial polarization.
Okay, and the Hamiltonian corresponds with that coordinate.
Exactly. Yeah. So maybe let me write that down because I can.
Yeah. Yeah, also because within this framework of geometric quantization. Introduce notions of, well, for sure we haven't introduced notions of operators or, I mean, we can if, well, but, and so, and I would associate spectra with, yeah, some sort of property of an operator acting on a Hilbert space. And so,
yes.
And so in this case, we went around it in a way, in a sort of, we bypassed that, or indirectly, we somehow arrived at a spectra, even though we haven't actually defined machinery related to operators under, no? So.
That's true, but you know, you could look at this example and say, you could figure out how some quantities act on the Hilbert space. It's a bit tricky, actually. But you could think, we go back to our example with the torus. Yeah, there we had our p's and q's, and we could figure out how all the operators were because we could just guess that p rotates along the q variable. So here, you could try to think about an operator which shifts you between the different states by dilating you in the radial direction.
Yeah.
And I think you could probably figure out all operators by being clever with that. So then the natural operator that would do that would be e to the 2 pi I theta.
Should we still be thinking of these states as maps from the Bohr-Sommerfeld points to the complex plane?
Yes.
Psi n we should think of as a function?
Yeah, it's a psi n like a delta function at the nth Bohr-Sommerfeld point.
Maybe one last thing. So is it always possible to do that, to find a coordinate system in which one of the coordinates is related to the Hamiltonian, and therefore finding the phase space of that coordinate is going to be the spectrum or the eigenstates of the operator? Of the
no.
It's not always possible.
Okay. No, so you got, yeah. So, like, when does this work? I'm going to give a definition which might be a bit too restrictive. You can probably do better than this, but it is a definition where this kind of thing will work. So M omega H is classically integrable. If we can find what are called action angle variables, which means say n functions on M, where these guys Poisson commute, so this means you can use them to polarize a vector f that polarizes. And the second thing is that the orbits of the n vector fields are orbits equivalent fiber of this vector f are tori. There's n copies. And three, the Hamiltonian is one of the f's. So then we have this picture that M locally looks like n, you know, product of n circles. And the Hamiltonian is going to flow you around these circles. and then some other variables in the base. So in this setting, you have a hope of running this Borsum-Raphael game. Compute spectrum of H. So in particular, if M was of dimension 2, things will be nice as long as all of the classical Hamiltonian has periodic orbits. But if the classical Hamiltonian is some kind of chaotic thing, or if I flow, I just wind around in strange spirals or something, you're not going to have a good, it's not going to work very nicely. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
I'm not sure I'm totally on board with why they have to be tori rather than just some like repeating pattern that doesn't have to necessarily close on itself in a circular manner.
Well, you want them, I think you don't want this kind of thing going off like, because you want the fibers to be, to apply this nice method, you want the fibers to be compact manifolds.
Can any compact manifold have, like, is it a requirement for the fibers to then be in tori?
No, this is, so this constraint that they're all tori is maybe a little stronger than is ultimately necessary. So having them all tori means you have nice, you know, there's nice angle coordinates, and my Hamiltonian just kind of shifts them around. That's a very strong constraint. You could probably get away with something a bit weaker than that.
Sorry, can you explain a third point again? What is h equals 1 of the x?
Well, I want, you look back to this example. So we polarized by mapping the plane via the radius to the positive real numbers. So here we have, here's the plane. I'm going to draw it like this. We'll call this a cigar, and our polarization, I was mapping the plane to the real numbers by the radius. And things worked really well because the Hamiltonian is expressed in terms of the radius, or squared. And if the Hamiltonian wasn't or squared, then once I take my Borsum-Raphael orbits, like this, I have my special circles. If the Hamiltonian wasn't expressed in terms of the radius, and it wouldn't take a constant value on these circles. And I couldn't really say that those circles represented eigenstates. For instance, if I removed the origin and I tried to polarize by angle, then things would be much more complicated and the Hamiltonian wouldn't be diagonalizable in the basis of the Hilbert space.
Somehow related to
simplicity. Yeah, that's actually a really good question. Somehow we're saying that the Hamiltonian is part of a UN action, or at least a U1 to the N action. So yes, I suppose it is. You could say, you know, at least in the two-dimensional case, the key thing is that the Hamiltonian was periodic. And that means the Hamiltonian gives you a U1 action, which is a very strong symmetry of my system. You know, any system has an action of the group OR by time translation. But,
yeah. I'm struggling a bit to see what's the fiber bundle. Like, what is the base space?
The base space is just the positive reals.
In this case, I see it. And
yeah.
Circles are R. In this case, general for F, what is the?
Oh, the base space is the real numbers. There's some patch in the real numbers. If I wanted to look like this, I would take log of R.
Okay.
Just to change coordinates. It doesn't have to be all of R, it could be some open domain. And then the fibers are tori, at least generically, and perhaps there are points where the tori collapse.
Okay.
Like
the angle.
Like here, for example, the circle collapsed to a point. That's something you want to allow.
And one other thing, this might be very obscure. I've heard of something like, I think it's Kapp or Kamm theorem. I think it's somehow related to chaos and tori of solutions to how does this relate to that in any way, or isn't there something like that? The Kolmogorov-Arnold something theorem.
Moser. I'm not familiar with that. Maybe, are you familiar with what the theorem says?
It's about like the, I think, okay, I cannot really state it in a like short way probably because I'm not also, I just heard the definition earlier. It's about like stability of these tori on in the phase space.
Mm-hmm.
Calculating their frequencies and their the ratios of the frequencies, if it's like a rational number, they are instable under some perturbations and stuff like that.
There's a massive literature about classical and quantum integrability from this perspective. I mean, thousands of papers.
I was wondering if you could expand on the statement that you just made, which is the Hamiltonian giving us a U1 action in the phase space led us to choose a gauge field that transformed under U1. If the Hamiltonian had, let's say, a different group of symmetries, would we, let's say SUN, for example, then would we pick a gauge field that transforms under SUN? Like, I'm trying to understand
this construction. That wasn't what I intended to convey, but it's an interesting point. I just meant, when I said the Hamiltonian gives a U1 action, all I meant was, because the orbits of the Hamiltonian come back to themselves, I get this nice vibration of my manifold over the real numbers by circles. And if the if the orbits didn't come back to themselves, the loci where the Hamiltonian was constant would be really complicated, and I wouldn't have this nice picture. I hadn't thought of connecting it to that U1 gauge field. I don't know if there is a connection. I mean, they both have or squared in them, but I don't know. No, I think it's different. Hamiltonian is an action of U1 on the phase space, whereas that's a gauge field on the phase space. Those are kind of different objects, different, geometrically different kind of objects. They're
compatible, but I don't think one forces the other.
Yes.
The gauge field has to transform back to itself under.
Yes, exactly. The gauge field should, exactly. But that's almost guaranteed because by the nature of the Hamiltonian, and the Hamiltonian flows preserve the symplectic form, therefore they preserve the field strength of the gauge field. Okay, so. Next example I want to try and discuss is the two-sphere. So all we're going to find by studying a system whose phase space is the two-sphere, and by studying its quantization, we're going to see things like spin and angular momentum and Pauli matrices from quantum mechanics.
So,
two-sphere is the locus for x squared plus y squared plus z squared. It's on, of course, and the symplectic form is just like this. And I'm going to put in some normalizing factor, which I wrote down, and I hope I got it right. So 1 over 2 pi h bar. We notice that on or 3, d omega is 3 over 2 pi h bar dx dy z. Because each of these guys contributes dx dy dz, because of the sine rules. Now, I want to, the volume of the two spheres is going to play an important role, so we have to normalize it. We have to think about what that volume is with this two form. How do we do that? Well, the integral over the two sphere of omega is the integral over all of d omega. And as we learn by looking the formula up on Wikipedia, the volume of the ball is 4 pi over 3. And that is 2 over r.
One question, the symplectic form. Where did we get this? That's a symplectic form in R3? Asymplectic? No, they cannot. It's not. So wait, what am I thinking? So that's a symplectic form in the sphere.
Yes. I'm going to ask, how do you know it's a symplectic form in the sphere?
I mean, there's like a canonical one. It's like a.
This is the canonical one, yeah.
Okay.
But
For a second, I thought we were inducing it from R3, it seemed.
It is restricted from R3, but on R3, it's neither closed nor non-degenerate. It's not closed because d of it is dx dy dz, but dx dy dz is zero on the two-sphere. So there are no three forms in the two-sphere.
Yeah, okay.
So how do we know this is the right thing? Well, you just have to check that it's invariant under the symmetries of the problem, which is SO3. And it is invariant under SO3 because I take the vector field which dilates everything uniformly.
Grows radially, or
yeah, the vector field like or d by r. This two form is you get it by contracting the volume form of the dilation vector field. This both expressions are SO3 invariant, so is this.
Okay. So we did do that. We did build the two form in R3, and so we pulled it back to the sphere.
Yeah.
It was a two form that preserved SO3 or invariant under SO3. Okay.
Yeah, so there's only one two form that's invariant under SO3 because a two form that in a two dimensional manifold, two forms only have one component. So if it's invariant under SO3, it has to be constant everywhere.
Sorry, Kyle. Did you say again the argument when it's SO3 invariant? The contraction was.
So up to a constant, omega is given by a contraction of v dx dy dz, where v is x del x plus y del y plus z del z is the dilation vector field. There are other ways. You can just, if you really want, you can just play around with the matrices of SO3 and just check. Okay. So let's answer the following question. What are the Poisson brackets? Of x, y, z. Or equivalently, what is a vector field? Well, you can compute that if the vector field associated to Z is given by 2 pi h bar times and similarly for the vector fields associated to x and y. So this should be familiar. This is rotation. I draw my sphere. And this projects the real line by z. The vector field rotates around an axis, which is points in the z direction. Would you, should I do this computation? No? You don't want to? All right.
Which computation, sorry?
The computation that this vector field is that. Okay. Okay, so let's assume this. And then, well, what does this tell us? It tells us that the functions x, y, and z, oh, look at this vector field. You know, what is, for instance, z times y is equal to x, z times y. And I go over here and I say, well, x, z has a d by dy in it. Complete by x. So that's 2 pi h bar x. And similarly, y times x is 2 pi h bar times z, and x times z is 2 pi r times y. OK. So are these expressions familiar to you guys? Yeah. They're polymatrices, yes.
Should they be xz or xy? No, I think I'm missing something.
Xz is the vector field.
Yeah.
And the way x, there's this relation between the Poisson bracket and the vector field built from a function. Poisson bracket of z with anything is xz times.
What is z? The coordinate function that gives
you z is the coordinate function.
I would associate. Oh, I have to think more about why that relation is the case.
Well, I mean, it's a general relation. X, f, g.
Ah, okay. The definition of, the definition under. Okay, in a symplectic.
Okay. So let's compute the Hilbert space.
Maybe just one quick remark about the last question. So, what I found counterintuitive is so that the coordinate functions act as the generators of rotations, and I didn't.
Yes.
I hadn't. And that seemed general. We didn't. Okay.
I mean, it's just.
Yeah.
I mean,
generate director field then.
It has to be something like that because the vector field generated by Z preserves Z because of the anti-commutativity of the Poisson relation. So whatever the vector field generated by Z is, it's some multiple of rotation.
Along Z.
Along that, you know.
Yeah, or rather, the plane perpendicular to Z, yeah.
Exactly. So it has. So it could be, you know, in principle, it could be that you take rotation and you multiply it by some function of Z or something. But you just compute it and it's just rotation.
Yeah. And normally I would say that the angular momentum will be the generator of rotations along an axis, not the clip. So I would put the I wouldn't have called Z. So why is that instinct breaking down? Why am I having a false instinct there? You know what I mean? Do you understand what? Normally the angular momentum along the Z direction would be the generator of rotations along that axis. And so I would have naively guessed, okay, LZ acting on something is the rotations along that.
But it is rotations with the z-axis. I mean, my right-hand rule, my thumb pointing along z.
No, that for sure. Never.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what's the Hilbert space? Let's see. I'm gonna polarize using z. And we saw that the volume is 2 over h bar. So h bar, and this should be an integer. I'm going to take h bar to be 2 over n. I want the volume to be an integer. Okay, so for this computation, I'm going to be a little lazy and not actually go and compute every detail. In particular, I'm not going to write down A. This Z goes from minus 1, 1. So there's a state. There's a state at the bottom where Z is minus 1. And if I take this disk to have integer area, we get another state there. Or we get a state every time I get a state every time I move up on the z interval in such a way that this cylinder has integer area. Okay, so we can go away and compute that area by studying that interval. The problem with so much symmetry, though, it's not hard to figure out what it has to be. So it turns out these four Sommerfeld points are equally spaced. So what's the spacing? If the area is 1, then there's going to be 2 things, minus 1 to 1. So there are points minus 1 plus something like 2k over the area. Can you hear that? Yeah, I think that's right. Okay, but we're mostly going to focus on the case when the area is 1.
Is that the area of the bottom point, or?
Oh, there's their positions along the z-axis, and the relevant locus in the z-axis starts at minus 1 and ends at 1. That's the z coordinate for the north and south pole.
Sorry, how did you get the volume for the entire? Why is it 2 over h bar?
Was it?
Why is the volume 2 over h bar?
Oh,
I see.
I will disappear and then I computed the integral over the.
One question. Also, in this case, the manifold doesn't vibrate in the same way as it did before. And so when did we, shouldn't, are we applying the condition that some alpha, the integral, or some loop has to be an integer valued or something? When are we, how can we do that if we don't have a fiber?
We do. I mean, it's okay to have your fiber shrink to a point.
Huh?
It's okay to have the fiber shrink to a point.
Ah, okay, so it's.
Yeah, and I'm skipping some steps. And the reason is I'm too lazy to write down a formula for alpha. Because there is no global formula for alpha, you'd have to, it has a non, this cohomology loss is non-trivial, and you have to think about the gate transformation.
Okay.
But that's okay, because we know if whatever happens down here, this shrinks to a point, not possible to have any, if I integrate alpha over this constant circle, which is a point, of course I get the identity.
Okay.
And then for this one, you know that the difference between these two guys is always the area. So the points just have to be the ones given by disks, the boundaries of disks of integral area.
And the area thing is related to the fact that our omega is the area of the sphere, is telling us we chose the form to be.
Yeah, omega gives the area form of the sphere because it's SO3 invariant.
Okay.
And then there's a geometrical fact that disks of integral area, their z coordinates I'm claiming are equally spaced, but we're not going to use that. So let's focus on the case where the area is 1. Then the Hilbert space has 2 states. The up state, the down state, and the up state. And Z on the down state is minus 1. So the thing I want to claim is that if you compute the Hilbert space and how the coordinate functions act on them, X, Y, and Z act by the literal Pauli matrices. There's the Pauli matrices. Well, clearly, sigma 3 is 1 minus 1 is Z. And these satisfy, you know, sigma 1, sigma 2 is 2i, sigma 3. And that's maybe I'm missing a factor of 2 pi. Oh, no, I'm not actually. Whereas here we have x, y is equal to minus z 2 pi h bar, so that x, y is equal to z times h bar I. And finally, h bar should be 2 because the volume is 1.
Like block sphere states here that are being translated
by Z, or are they which state?
Like traditional quantum mechanical, like block sphere states.
Yeah.
And then this is, think of Z as like a translation. So.
Well, I mean here, Z is the polymetric sigma 3. It takes value. It is the Pauli matrix takes these values minus 1 and 1 because the function z takes values minus 1 and 1 on those points.
So we're bringing in to like the Bohr-Sommerfeld formalism, traditional quantum mechanical notions.
Yes, exactly. So if we wanted to, so what question is this answering? You might ask, you like might like to study a qubit or a spin system. And when you look at a qubit, you know, it's two-dimensional Hilbert space with Pauli matrices acting on it. You might have thought this doesn't come from any Lagrangian or any semi-classical system. But actually, it does. The qubit is what you get when you have a particle moving along a sphere of area 1.
A question that is related to that. If that was the case, shouldn't our original phase space be also include the momentum coordinates? Because we just started with x, y, z, and somehow it was okay to neglect.
Good question. So when I say it's a particle moving around the sphere, I didn't mean it was a particle with the second order, the usual second order Lagrangian moving along the sphere. It's the particle with the first order Lagrangian moving around the sphere. So how do we get, remember when we said, if we have a symplectic manifold, I can build a Lagrangian where the field is some gamma, I think, or S2. And then we wrote this action where if like omega was d alpha, the action was, which locally looks like integral, you know, pdq. It's a Lagrangian of the form PDQ, first order Lagrangian. But here, P and Q are coordinates on a patch on the sphere. Now, you might wonder, is there some more familiar second-order Lagrangian which gives you that? And there kind of isn't, because anytime you have a second-order Lagrangian, then P takes values in the real numbers, so you have some non-compact directions in your manifold, which you don't have here.
And when you speak of first order and second order, for instance, one should think of, like fermions usually have a, in the Lagrangian, there's only one time derivative.
That's exactly.
The number of time derivatives.
The number of time derivatives. Okay. Are there any other questions about this? We've kind of concluded that, it's clear from this picture why Z is sigma 3. But it's not obvious, except by looking at the commutational relations, why X and Y are sigma 1 and sigma 2. I think you can kind of think about it, what does X, Z rotates along the vertical axis. So X and Y must rotate along the other two axes. So X must flip the two states. Well, there must be there's secretly some kind of exponentiation going on. But sigma 3 looks sigma 1, X. What's the matrix? This looks like this. Both of these flip north and south poles. Which I certainly find geometrically suggestive, because rotation along those axes also has that feature.
Even though it's infinitesimal, right? Usually and it would seem like to flip, you would need like a pretty big rotation.
That's right, but I think I'm having trouble pinning it all down, but I think we saw something when we studied the case of the torus. There was something like this, where P became an exponentiation of the derivative in Q. So I think that's
okay.
I think that's what must be going on. Okay, what happens if the volume of the two sphere is equal to n? So then Hilbert space has n plus 1 states, and n times z takes integer values. Namely, minus n, 2 minus n. 2n. So we might hope that n times x and n times y continue to satisfy the algebra of the polymatrices. This will indeed be true. And you find that they give a representation of SU2 of dimension n plus 1. So in this way, all represent, you know, I don't know if anybody has studied the representation theory of SU2, but this is the complete list of the representations of SU2, and all of them appear by thinking about a particle moving along a sphere, the volume with integer volume. I think I'm out of things to say, so I won't say any more. Well, maybe one more thing. There's a really fun story. Whereas you might say, well, this is just for SU2. Can I build representations of my favorite other group, like E8 or something, in this way? And there's something called the Borel-Weil theory, which will build for you a symplectic manifold with the symplectic form such that the Hilbert space is any representation you choose of any group. And it's a nice way of understanding representation.
Can you explain in what way this is like satisfying our vibration by tori? By, is this supposed to be S1 cross S1 for a two-dimensional space?
So it satisfies a slightly weaker version of that. So the base manifold is this interval instead of the real numbers. So it's a domain in the real numbers. And instead of every fiber being a circle, it's almost every fiber is a circle. Every fiber except the north and the south poles.
But this is kind of like an S1 cross R, right?
Well, so the general story with this vibration by tori, you want, there's going to be some base manifold, and the fibers are circles. So the fiber is, I'm going to fix the value of z. The things living over that value of z is indeed a circle.
So the fibers are like one dimensional less.
Exactly. In the higher dimensional story, the fibers are half the dimension. Because I want to have, if I start with something of dimension 2n, the base should be of dimension n, and the fibers are also of dimension n.
I'm trying to understand how states in the Hilbert space correspond to that picture of the vibration that we have. So my understanding was that I don't know how to call it, but this sliver of area is correspond. Sorry, each circular orbit on S2 corresponds to a VS point, right?
Mm-hmm.
And corresponding to that is some state in the Hilbert space.
Yes, exactly.
The global Hilbert space is a direct sum of.
Exactly. Yeah, the direct sum of those. You get one copy of the complex numbers for each of these circles.
But then it seems like we only have two states.
Well, so for the case, the usual polymatrices, I wanted to focus on the case the area is one. So the two states were the top and the bottom. But I didn't have, you know, I started here and I had to fill it in by a disk of area one. That meant that because the whole sphere is area one, that meant I had to go all the way to the top.
Well, I don't fully understand why nz. Probably it's just something about the scaling here. The algebra contains h 2 pi h bars in front. That's proportional to n or something, or inversely.
It's just something about the scaling. You want these computational relations to satisfy. H bar is like goes like 1 over n.
Okay.
And you want it when you quantize, you don't want the n's in the computational relation.
Okay. So it's ultimately n times z that satisfies the rotation algebra.
Yeah, exactly.
As you do, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
No, I mean, think about it. There's another basis by which things are probably more transparent, what's going on. Instead of using X, Y, and Z, you use Z and these matrices. E, F, this one. This is more transparent because these just move you from one state to the next, up or down. The vector fields flow you up and down the sphere. But you can kind of see them.
Well, I was thinking about my confusion before about how it's normally not the coordinate functions that generate the rotation algebra. And I think it's ultimately related to the symplectic form we chose. So it's only with, like, normally in normal quantum mechanics, we use a different symplectic form. And so the coordinates form a different algebra, the Heisenberg algebra, the canonical commutation relay. No, they commute. They just commute. They just commute. Or something. So it's related to the symplectic
yes.
form
yeah.
shows that turns out they form.
Yeah, so normally the coordinates would have a canonically conjugate coordinate.
Yeah, yeah.
But here we don't because it's a first order system.
And and they don't commute, but rather they form this algebra. Yeah.
What if we use zeta and pi instead of x, y, z? I can start from here.
If we use which, sorry?
Zeta and pi, then we can construct the d zeta of h d phi.
Oh, so like theta was an angular coordinate here, you mean? Yeah, it would be a bit nasty, though. It's not. I think you could do it, but it's a little nasty because theta is badly behaved here. And that's it. Not so good because that point is really important because it's a state. But you probably could do something.
I thought that had been partly what we did, though, in the sense of when we hid the nastiness of doing the integral over loops, that when partly what we were doing was writing omega. Well, or it's not partly, well, could it be framed in that way?
I think you could do it. I just think it would be more cumbersome than we did.
Would it be possible to go through this using the deformation quantization by like I don't know, in the beginning, like defining some Moyal product, and in the end still arriving at like recovering these Pauli matrices on this algebra?
Yeah, well, let's see. We did kind of most of that, right? Because we figured out the Poisson bracket, and that's the first term in the Moyal product.
So would you need to calculate other terms if you were following that technique? And then like see where those terms end up?
Yes, so I think like because the symplectic form has this like slightly complicated expression with three terms, I am not seeing in my head exactly how will work, but I think you'll find that the other terms just don't contribute. And that the Moyal product will just involve this term, and then the expansion will stop after that.
So they'd really be the same in this?
I think so, yeah.
Maybe would it be possible to recover the Moyal algebra out of the, because once we build the operators, that is the algebra they generate is, well, I suppose honest to God, the quantum mechanical algebra underlying
yes.
the full algebra, not first order approximation. So would we be able to generate all the other terms out of that one, all the other terms in the expansion somehow, in the H-bar expansion?
Yes. Well, if you think about it, how it works in the plane. You know, if I take two complicated functions and their Moyal product is going to be a very complicated expression. But that's determined algebraically by the expression for P and Q. And for P and Q, the expansion just truncates immediately. There's going to be something similar here. I think for these generators of the algebra X, Y, and Z, the expansion truncates. And that determines algebraically all the more complicated things. And what you find, if you're a mathematician, you might think, oh, this is going to be something called the universal enveloping algebra of SO3, which it is, but it's quotiented by the relation which says that the radius is 1 over n. Because I have to renormalize x, y, and z by n, and then normal, it's a sphere of radius 1. So this is a standard thing in algebra where you set the quadratic Casimir to their value.